This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You're in for a treat today as we listen back to some of Hawaii's history. Specifically, we're looking at Waikiki, its past, present, and future. Our guests include Dolan Ebersole, a coastal geologist with the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College. He's here to talk about managing our coastal resources as we face rising warming waters. And Andrew Rossiter, he's been the director of the Waikiki Aquarium since 2004, following long stints in Japan, Canada, and Africa. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, we start this morning with a look back, and we do that with the help of our partners at the University of Hawaii's Center for Oral History. They've compiled some interviews done with people who lived in Waikiki in the early part of the 20th century. And HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, is here to pick up that part of the story.
Yeah, you bet. Catherine, as you say, this is another project with the UH Center for Oral History. Director Daviana McGregor and Lurleen McGregor, their entire team, have done some great work in tracking down voices, and we're happy to share several of them this morning. We do ask for your patience. Understand that these were recorded some time ago, and it'll take a little getting used to in terms of some of the audio at the start. We're going to play them in two sets, starting with some memories of sea life in Waikiki in the days before the Alawai Canal was built. They started to dredge for the canal in 1921. It took them 7 years to complete. It was a project that changed the entire nature of Waikiki, which had previously been swamps, marshlands, fish ponds, lots of rivers twisting through the area. It was also filled with all kinds of sea life. Davali Notley Steer was born in 1915 in Honolulu, was better known by her nickname Tootsie. She starts by talking about the side of Waikiki up by where the Hilton Hawaiian Village is now, but long before that man-made lagoon was created.
That bay where the Hawaiian Village is now, before they built all these hotels, you know, Ilikai and all that, and the Hawaiian Village, that bay used to be one of the most productive producing seafood base I've ever known. We used to know the kinds of seafood that used to come into that bay at different times of the year. The white, the shrimps, the crabs, the alamihi, the different kinds of fishes. There was this big reef starting there all the way down to Pea Point and over to Port Lucie. That was our lobster bed. But they were very careful that they never gave away or ate the babies. Always put that. The babies, they saved the babies.
Did a lot of the neighborhood women?
Yes, and of course. Yeah, but you know, when there was time to pick, and there was time to pick, everybody would not pick the same time. Mm. But yeah, the crowd, the different Hawaiian would go out and they pick. They clean the clutter, and then whoever will go out to help to pick. They divide the liver.
So did they have seasons when you could?
Yes, there were seasons for different tea leaf, for different, right in that bay. Mm. And seasons for, and you know, oh, I'm telling you, when the crabs, the big white crabs were done, well, you already said they were just, so what we used to do, well, especially was those crab season, when they come in, oh, they come in by the thousands. Mm. So we would line up the beach and we'd have these long, well, actually they should take sheets and strip them. We save the strip. And when the wave brings them in, we take it and we scoop the beach and throw the crabs on the dry part of the shore from the beach.
With the sheets?
With the sheets, yeah. Just scoop them like this way. Then the others who were on the outside would gather all the crabs and put them in the bags.
Wow, there was a lot of crabs there.
Oh, listen, thousands.
What kind of crab was that?
That's a kind of big white crab. You boil them and you... Yeah. Right, yeah. And then the others, we used to, you know, for eat raw. The ones that the babies, that's the one they used to save to eat raw with the eggs. Mm-hmm. But the others, they would cook, you know. So we used to have bonfire, big gallons in it. And what? And we cook and we used to eat crab on the beach. Mm. That's the season. They used to last about sometimes 1 week, too. Maybe a little bit more than 1 week. Then another season would be when the opais came in. Well, I would come scoop up them up and throw them in the run up and throw it in the big containers. And then we divide them, we take it home, eat and fix it, because they used to know how to fix those things in the eat more. Then another season was when all the alamihis came. And we don't know where the alamihis came from, but they can't be in there. They really hang around the rocks. Mm-hmm. And we'd scoop those up. And we used to have about 8 big seasons, or maybe even 10 big seasons a year.
Hearing the creak of a rocking chair there, along with the memories. Tootsie, by the way, studied hula. She became a professional hula dancer in the mainland for a time and returned to Hawaii and to Waikiki. She was part of the Kodak Hula Show for many years. Wilbur Craw, okay, is someone that we're going to be hearing from in a bit. He spent a lot of time on the other side of Waikiki. We're going to get to Wilbur in just a bit, I think, but to talk about some of that abundance of sea life that was so much part of old Waikiki, really.
Yeah, Andrew, I mean, do you know the type of crab that she was talking about?
No, I don't. It's very, very rare to see crabs in that kind of abundance nowadays in Waikiki. And the anecdotes about the huge diversity of fishes and the abundance of marine life, they're absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, what's the snapshot now? I mean, I know, Dolan, we were talking earlier, you swim out in that area, I swim out there. We see what's there now, and it's not as rich and vibrant maybe as it once was.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Anybody that's spent any time in Waikiki could see that it's not what it used to be. And, you know, we can attribute that to a whole bunch of different things, but I think it's at least from a observational standpoint, it certainly doesn't have the marine life that it used to.
And are there studies that kind of document what was there before, Andrew?
You know, the probably the best scientific studies are the ones that were done on the marine algae, which were collected as food. There are some very, very basic studies, surveys of fish populations, but nothing that you can really use as a baseline to compare to what's there today, which is kind of sad because, you know, the aquarium is right in front of the reef there. Surely some sort of studies could or should have been done in the past.
And there are all these special protections with that marine conservation district.
Yes, yeah. The Marine Life Conservation District is, I think, pivotal to what little diversity survives now in Waikiki. If that weren't there, I think things would be much, much worse.
And then, Dolan, what can you add just about the warming, you know, issue?
Yeah, the world is a warming place. We hear repeatedly, almost weekly now in the local media, something about sea level rise and climate change. at the university, we are closely monitoring the science behind that, particularly as we think it may impact Hawaii. So we're looking to go beyond just the global climate science into what are the potential impacts to Hawaii. And as an example of that, the State Department of Land and Natural Resources just recently, well, a year ago, released a risk and vulnerability assessment report with respect to sea level rise for the state of Hawaii. So they're really nice, high quality and high resolution maps for all the coast of Hawaii looking at potential impacts of sea level rise and interesting combination of effects, things like if you add sea level plus high surf plus erosion, what they call the sea level rise exposure area has been defined. And we can think of this new coastal hazard area as the potential area that could be exposed to sea level plus erosion in the future. That's really, really powerful information for coastal managers and elected officials to start to think more critically about what we're putting and where.
And those changes historically when they happen, for example, going back to digging the alawai and dredging that and really changing the nature of the whole ecosystem in that area and what used to be the mix of fresh water coming down mixed with the salt water and the brackish and all the rest of that, that really changed a lot in terms of the universe there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I give a lot of presentations on Waikiki and some of the work that we're doing in to maintain and restore beaches in Waikiki. And I usually start my talks with that point, which is Waikiki is a completely altered environment. There's not much on the shoreline in Waikiki that it's in a natural state. It's been altered for 100 years in some places. So that changes the context at least somewhat. And when we talk about restoration, we need to really think carefully about what that means, because it's really hard for me to envision that we're going to restore it back to an original state. Mm. You mentioned the dredging and the filling of Waikiki. It looks completely different than it did 100 years ago, and that's true on the shoreline as well. And we've been working closely with the State Department of Land and Natural Resources and the Waikiki industry, or the hotel industry in Waikiki, to try to define what the vision of the future of the beach in Waikiki might look like. We have the technical ability and through engineering and science to design beaches that we might desire, but we're trying to get to that question of what is the vision, the stakeholder vision, the community vision for Waikiki before we even get to designs.
And just one touch more on the past of that. I think we have some sound ready with a man named Wilbur Craw, who's spent a lot of time on the other side of Waikiki, that going more toward the Diamond Head side. Born in Makiki in 1914, eventually became part of the Beach Boys. He was a powerful swimmer, trained with future Olympian Buster Crabbe. But a lot of Wilbur's memories focused on a different kind of water, not so much the seawater, but the local streams.
The old Outrigger Club was built on the banks of a stream that came out into the water between the Moana Hotel and the Seaside Hotel, which is now the present site of the Royal Hawaiian. And that stream went up. The bridge was built across Kalakaua Avenue, low concrete bridge, almost flat with the road. And then the stream went up into the duck pond. And we used to paddle surfboards up there, small kids, and go and look at the duck ponds, the rice paddies, the taro patches. Now and then you'd see duck eggs, you know. You swipe the duck eggs, you know what the hell for. Used to be kind of adventurous, you know, all these waterways going up all around, which is all built up now in high rises. Then when we would get back down, we would go fishing in the stream, because they had a lot of these little baby fish. I guess you might call them mosquito fish. When the stream would open up and the water would come in, if it was moist season or warmer season, some of these fish would go up in there. And actually, some of the regular fish, like manini and stuff, they became acclimated to the water. At the entrance is more brackish. But they made the change over. Oh, in the streams there was mullet. Oh, yeah, there's mullet swimming all over the place. Waikiki was very famous for its limu. They had lipoa, they had manuea, they had huluhuluvaina. They had some spots there, vaivai ioli. Only thing that you couldn't find too much of, and it wasn't a good place for it, was lipepe. The whole area has changed. You see, as soon as everybody along the coastline or the hotels and all of that, they put in swimming tanks. Okay, to keep the algae from growing, they put chlorine in it. Then, to save pumping it into the sewer, they drain it into the water. So as a result, the limu beds that used to be plentiful around Diamond Head, they're all wiped out. When you had a lot of limu, you had a lot of fish come in and eat. Because I can recall when the house that we had was right on the water, and you could see all kinds of fish coming in. Or you could see big ulua coming in. Sometimes they come in and the water drains off the reef, and they'd lay on their side and flap, going out on their side. I'm not kidding you, I've seen it.
Yeah, famous for limu and the fish that would attract along with that.
Now, Andrew, I don't know if you want to jump in here, because, you know, I know you folks have been doing lots of studies with the seaweed out there. I think it was Celia.
Dr. Celia Smith of the Smith. University Department of Botany, she's been spearheading an algal, alien algae removal project for the past 15 plus years. So it's the longest algae removal project in Hawaii. And basically, there's a community effort. People from various groups come down at regular intervals, usually about 2-monthly intervals. School groups come down, companies for the weekend to help clear out the alien algae. And it's critically important in the terms of this project, because they are taught to identify what is alien and what is native, rather than just clear-cutting everything. So the native stuff is left there, the alien algae is removed. Then it's taken on shore and it's identified to species, and then it's weighed. So in that way, we can get a baseline of how much algae there is, productivity, over every two-month interval. And so there's a really good, solid scientific basis for the alien algae removal project and how well the native algae is recovering. And as alluded to by the previous speaker, having a native algae community there is critical in underpinning the diversity of invertebrates and the diversity of fishes that live there.
Now, the invasives, they were brought in, I think, because they thought they would be a real boon, right, for commercial harvesting of seaweed. And it didn't go right.
Yeah, they were brought in for commercial purposes. And perhaps I'm only half sure about this, but I think the persons who were running the project, when the project finished, they didn't remove the trial plantings that took place on the reef, and from that, many of the species, or several of the species of alien algae, have now broken off, propagated, and have spread right around the shoreline of Oahu.
And I know Celia's got some projects going where she's growing some of the natives, I think, on limestone tiles that you can get at the hardware store, and then they're planting them along the reef to try and get them to rebound.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and some of that work has been done at the aquarium as well, with growing these seedlings, if you want to call them. Not as easy as it sounds. It's a very complicated process, and Celia's group's making great inroads into doing that successfully.
I'm just struck by listening into those interviews about how lots of folks depended on that whole reef area for food.
And the whole seasonality of it, too, of just that, the cycles of nature that have been just disrupted and destroyed a lot in terms of the construction, the reimagining of what was naturally there. You mentioned, by the way, we're talking about Waikiki, past, future. We'd like to know what you think. You can join the discussion calling us at 941-3689, Neighbor Islands 1-877-941-3689.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to mention, Dolan's already spoken about the changes in the climate and sea level rise, etc. This is a personal observation, purely anecdotal, but my office is right next to the reef. I'm on the second floor, and I can look down on a reef. It's about 15, 20 feet away. When I first came to the aquarium 15 years ago, whenever there was a high tide, you could hear the waves splashing against the seawall, and if you went out to the window and looked down, you could see the splashings. Over the past 3 to 4 years, whenever there's a high tide and a wind behind it, those waves hit the wall, and they rise higher than my two-story building, the splashes. And that change has happened in the past 15 years.
Well, you're working on a master plan for your facility too, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything you can share about that?
Very, very preliminary at the moment. But when I was talking to some architects about this, just a casual discussion, they said, what are you going to do about sea level rise? You know, your aquarium is going to be underwater in 50 to 80 years. And I said, you know, I'd rather not view that as a challenge. I'd view that as an opportunity, and it could be an opportunity in terms of building something new there that is able to withstand or to ameliorate the effects of sea level rise.
You think that's possible, Dolan?
Yeah, I do. I wanted to reflect on that, the recording that we just heard with the streams that bisect Waikiki, or used to bisect Waikiki. In a large part, that defines the beaches in Waikiki, is those paleo stream channels that cut through the reef, offer a way for sand to kind of leak offshore. So that these streams have literally defined what we think of as Waikiki. But I wanted to reflect on these streams in the context of climate adaptation, in that they offer a glimpse or an opportunity for us to think more strategically about what the future of Waikiki might look like, along the lines of what Andrew's describing, which is rather than perpetually battling the ocean and trying to fight it off, I think the future in the probably the 40 to 50 year plus time frame is to let the water come in and simply accommodate it in different ways. And we would have to obviously redesign a lot of our infrastructure. Our subsurface utilities would need to change. And there are a number of other places around the world that are successfully doing this. Northern Europe is really kind of struggling. Denmark and places like that are very low elevation. They've for hundreds of years have had to deal with high water levels and have found ways to accommodate it and through a combination of measures. So I don't know what the solution is, but I would really be interested in exploring what the future of Waikiki might look like if it was wetter. Maybe the Alawai Canal is not just a single canal, but a series of canals that connect through the existing canal and allow water to kind of come and go. There's already been talk about elevating structures, elevating ground floors. One may sound crazy now, but 20 years from now, we might be actually talking about raising Kalakaua Avenue so that it's actually at the first floor. So it's like a byway, an elevated pedestrian walkway, things like that. It's interesting to think about what is possible. But we talk about this quite a bit at the university with this idea of accommodating sea level rise, and it's certainly within our ability, our technical ability, to look at that. And places like Venice in Italy serve as an example of cities that have accommodated water for hundreds of years.
And Andrew, you were talking about the master plan for your facility, but right next to you is the Waikiki War Memorial Natatorium, we're in the middle of discussing what its future is going to be like, and we've got this draft EIS that's out. And I understand that part of the preferred alternative calls for shoring up the walls, which includes, I believe, putting in pilings. How are you looking at that?
I actually only heard about this yesterday. I'd be very, very cautious about doing pilings next to the aquarium because the vibrations that come from pilings will be transmitted through the ground and into the exhibits at the aquarium, and fish are very, very sensitive to vibration, much, much more so than humans.
And as far as the tanks, I mean, were they built to withstand?
The tanks will probably be structurally sound, but it's the fish and the animals living inside them that I would be most concerned about.
Okay, and you plan to weigh in on that?
Yeah, now that I know about it, I will, yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's a concern. I think people just need to know what's planned for that area, whether you're talking about sea level rise or, warming temperatures in the ocean. What do we have planned and how do we deal with it?
And that idea also, Dylan, that you were talking about earlier about lessons learned from elsewhere. I mean, we're not in isolation in terms of what is going on and that adaptability. What is to be learned in that area?
Yeah, I guess I'm a half glass, glass half full kind of guy. Similar to Andrew's point about not looking at sea level rise as a challenge as much as an opportunity, it certainly has its challenges, and we've done a lot of mapping on that. But there are a number of places around the world that have been dealing with sea level rise far longer than we have. Even places like Miami are well ahead of us in having to deal with what we call chronic erosion and nuisance flooding. So they're having to deal with things like every high tide, the streets flood. And it's not the end of the world. They're finding ways to deal with it. As far as a long-term resilient community, there are some challenges there, of course. But they're finding ways to deal with it in the short term with pumping out systems and raising the elevation of streets. There are some active discussions going on about how would that look in a place like Waikiki or Honolulu, for that matter. Where we start this is probably in our most critical high density areas like Waikiki and Kaka'ako, where there's a tremendous amount of infrastructure already. Mm-hmm. And I said earlier, I'm kind of more of an opportunistic or optimistic kind of guy. Looking at something like the rail coming in maybe is our opportunity to think more strategically about where subsurface utilities might go as that thing is built. Those are some of the opportunities I see. One of the challenges that I see with respect to groundwater table coming up right through the surface of the ground is we have our wastewater systems, storm drains that are typically gravity fed. So they're on a very low slope towards a forced main that pumps it to a wastewater treatment facility. Well, as sea level rises, those gravity fed systems aren't going to work anymore. So that's probably one of the low-hanging fruit is starting to think more carefully about our wastewater systems in high-density areas to start. Those communities that are a little higher elevation, as you get in that, you know, 6 to 8 to 10 feet above sea level, you're probably okay for at least 100 years or so. But those that are really low elevation along the coast, think Kakaako, Waikiki, pretty much all of our urban corridor in Honolulu, they're going to be faced with starting to wrestle with these. I wish I had more specific examples that I could give you that here's a place that we're looking carefully at. There is a lot of research going on right now to try to look at what other communities are doing. And there's a lot of attention being paid to that. So we're certainly not ignoring it and trying to learn from others as things develop.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We've been talking about Waikiki, and you can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
My name is Matt Beal. I'm the CEO and principal broker of Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, and we are proud underwriters of Hawaii Public Radio. I support HBR because the conversations that you have here are among the most important in Hawaii, plain and simple. Now more than ever, we need public discourse and we need independent voices, and Hawaii Public Radio does a great job of facilitating that need, facilitating that effort.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here.
Next time on The World, a surveillance system for the U.S.-Mexico border, a kind of electronic border wall. It tracks people on the move. A reporter put on virtual reality goggles and watched a test of the system.
And it said, 98% probability that this thing is a person. You could zoom in or even send a drone to look at it. You could see it's a person.
A virtual border wall on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
We are talking about Waikiki with Andrew Rossiter and Dolan Ebersole. And Bill Dorman, NPR's news director. We were discussing the Waikiki Auditorium, since that project is in the throes of, you know, what do we do? Do we rebuild it? Do we tear down the arch and rebuild it somewhere else and build a new beach? That's an important point to talk about because it's right next to your area, mm-hmm. Andrew. There's concern apparently about silt and the turbidity and the effect of some of that kicking up and affecting not only the beach on the other side, but also your area.
Yeah. The Natatorium has been essentially building up sediment over the past 50 or so years. Some of the reports I've read say it's about between 5 and 8 feet deep. The bottom layers of that have got no oxygen. It's anoxic. It's black. It's probably got lots of toxins in it. And our concern is that if one of the walls were to collapse or if they did the renovation improperly, the sea would be allowed to access the natatorium directly, and it would wash all of that sediment in a big plume in one direction, because the current there doesn't actually come from offshore to onshore. It actually comes along the shore, and it goes from the natatorium towards Waikiki. So essentially, if the walls were to collapse or there was an issue, the sediment would all be washed in a big plume from the natatorium right down to Waikiki, and on its way, it would go over the marine protected area and probably kill everything there.
I mean, that would be catastrophic.
It'd be absolutely catastrophic, yeah, yeah. And not only to the wildlife, but also to the tourist industry in Waikiki.
And Dolan, what about issues relating to the sea level rise if you've got a project there, you know, on the beach?
Yeah, that's a good question. A multi-million dollar question at that. I did look at the EIS for the natatorium, and I'm pleased to say that they do at least acknowledge sea level rise in the environmental assessment. They don't say specifically what they're going to do to accommodate sea level, but they do reference the DLNR study that I mentioned earlier with respect to what's been already documented for predictions for sea level rise. And they say that they will take provisions to accommodate up to 3.2 feet of sea level, which is what the state is recommending now for at least conceptually for new projects, is to consider up to 3.2 feet of sea level. What that looks like in the final design is yet to be determined, but they are at least acknowledging sea level in the report. It may be a simple matter of just raising the elevation of the perimeter walls that are proposed a couple, 2-3 feet to accommodate that. But it also gets to this question of, well, how long is this new restored natatorium intended to be there? If it's a legacy piece of infrastructure that's 100 years or more, that's going to be a real challenge to keep it in place, at least how it looks now. If it's a 40 to 50 year type, most coastal infrastructure is designed to last about 50 years, just to, you know, sea walls and groins and things like that. 50 years is a general engineering lifetime. So 50 years, we might be looking about 3 to 4 feet of sea level rise, which is probably something that we could accommodate. Beyond that, it's, you know, really hard to say what that area might look like.
So engineering is going to be key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got first-hand experience of concrete and rebar structures built right next to the ocean. The aquarium is now 61, 62 years old, so past the 50-year cutoff point, and it's really shown its age.
Yeah, and that's common throughout Waikiki. We see a lot of the seawalls and structures that were built 50 to 80 years ago are really starting to deteriorate now at a more accelerated pace, partly because they're hitting that age and partly because the ocean levels have been unusually high the last several years. You mentioned the splash earlier. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that throughout Waikiki, that things, the water level is unusually high. And we've all heard this term king tides now. Mm-hmm. That is a phenomenon that is not a new phenomenon. We just coined a new term for it. But it has been unusually high in a what I would call a temporary basis. So it's last two summers ago, it was almost a foot higher than it should have been, the water levels in Honolulu. That is going back down to near normal, but sea level is going to catch back up, and it's going to look like that all the time in probably 20 to 30 years.
And we do want to get to some of those voices from the University of Hawaii's Oral History Project. Bill, what else do you have on tap?
Yeah, so we heard in that first section of them about the sea life, and that's part of so many recollections of these folks who were there before the Alawai Canal was built. But also, you know, bear in mind tourism starting to pick up. We talked about the construction of the hotels, the rise of the Beach Boys on Waikiki, of course, part of that. Joseph Y.K. Akana spent decades as a Beach Boy, starting in the early 1920s. He was born in 1907, raised on Ohua Lane in Waikiki, described the time early in his life when his attention sort of shifted from education to being a beach boy.
I went to McKinney and I didn't graduate. I suppose to a lot, because when a Ramayana boat came in, the place to be was at the beach. Surfboard instructors, swimming, canoeing, taking people out in the canoe. Could make as much as $5 a day. Oh, was that big money.
So what age did you start making money on the beach?
Oh, about 14, but the big money came in the 30s. Everything, you know, everything we did cost money. Climb a coconut tree cost money, everything. But it didn't
matter. So when you first started on making money on the beach, who was running the beach services?
Well, in our place, Dudy Miller, the Hunala, all Hunala boys.
Where was Huinalu located?
In the bathhouse at the Moana Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest. Outrigger then started, because it was, Outrigger was just a beach club then. Mm-hmm. But later on, they had some boys, Hawaiian boys, that hung around there. So they started to start something too. But who now controls most of the business? Because we're all the experienced ones. And the best years, of course, were in the 30s. Real classic tourists who really spend money. They like the Beach Boys. The dredging of the canal didn't occur till about the early 20s. There was all calls came in from the canal. The dredger had pumps that pumped these drainage or whatever the coal and whatnot that was dug out was. That's the first time in my life I noticed suction, dredging by suction. In the olden, before that, you know, they used to have big clamshells that went down and grabbed the coal, lifted up, swung it across, and put them in trucks, and the trucks hauled them away. But it was just what was done with all with pipes. It sucked. The dredger would grind coal, and they had big pipes close by that sucked the coal right into a big pipeline, 24 to 30 inches diameter. Strong suction. That's how the Lamorna Shopping Center was organized. And the where the park is now used to be a dump, the city dump.
Lamorna Park?
Yeah, city dump.
A contemporary of Joseph was a man named Fred Paola. He was born in 1905, grew up in Waikiki. He talked a lot about fish, but also about how Waikiki in the days before the Alawai Canal could be transformed by the weather, and especially heavy rains.
Every time it rained hard, we didn't go to school. We were happy because we know what's going to happen. When it rained, all the ponds flooded. So we'd go down to the mouth of the stream and fish, catfish, mullets, pontoons. Pontoon looks like a pike. Yeah, they're big. Ducks, chicken, pigs, you name it, everything came down. You see, because everything was brought down. Usually the ducks are in the ponds and all that. Mm-hmm. And that water came so fast. And we used to stand out there, and the fish are caught in the shallow. And they're trying to, you could see the top of it. And everybody's rushing. We're catching all these fish here.
With a net?
With a net, yeah. Everybody had a net. Oh, I'd say 15, 20 people there, you know. All the neighbors around there. It's a big deal. We didn't sell it. We just took it home what we wanted. The pigs or something else.
Now, what did you do with the pigs?
Well, we ate it. We don't know who owned it.
The Alawai Canal, after it was built, what changes did you notice in that area?
After they reclaimed all that land, all the ponds were filled with the coral and all that. They were filled in there, including the strip that they had dredged outside the Dirasi and Hayton Horn Village, and Ilikai. They use all in to fill the Alamona Center now, all that swamp land, and the Holborn Estate, which is across from where we lived. All of that was filled in, even the stream, Pienaar River, was filled in. That's filled in, see? Including up where the tracks were, McCully Street. They filled all that. So they started developing, see? That's when property started going up. Well, it took a long time. I think the ones that developed first was the area down the Alamona. But out Waikiki, I don't know, it took a little time because they had that fill-in, they had to fill in topsoil and everything else in that area.
Did you notice any changes in the fishing in the area?
Oh, that's a big change. There are very few fishermen out there now because you can't get to the area. Now, you can't get to the beach area. Even if you got there, you can't fish because there's so many people in the and swimming and all that.
I miss the area very much. I miss it. I miss the fishing. I like to swim and fish. I like to get up at 5:30 in the morning, catch papillas, come home, cook it for breakfast, then go to work. And what the hell's better than that?
Hard to say what's better than that, but after his childhood in Waikiki, Fred Paola went on to a career with the Honolulu Police Department. But as with all of these people who spoke with the oral history folks, never lost that love of the water and of a Waikiki that had already changed immensely from the place where they grew up, and now we're looking at further changes.
No, we were listening to the Beach Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Dolan, is there going to be much beach for some of the folks out there? I know you've got an erosion control project, I think, fronting the Royal Hawaiian that you're working on, right?
Yeah, the state in partnership with the Waikiki Beach Special Improvement District has been working on some plans, a whole variety of plans for maintaining and restoring beaches throughout Waikiki. The first of which will be a replacement groin for the Royal Hawaiian groin. This has been in the works for several years now. It was finally approved by DLNR last year, and we're probably about a year away from it beginning construction. That project will not dramatically change the beach. It'll just make the Royal Hawaiian groin more stable, hopefully not as seasonally dynamic as it is now. But the beach won't look a lot different than it does now. There are some other projects that are being considered to put in a temporary sandbag groin right in front of the Duke Hanamoku statue at Kuhio Beach to stabilize a corner of that section of shoreline that has had an old foundation that's become exposed. It's kind of a problem area for the city, which administers that part through they're part of a city park. So those are the next two kind of construction projects. The next thing over the horizon is we're going to need more sand in Waikiki, as we're going to have to continue. We're really looking at a future of just continuous small-scale beach nourishment in Waikiki. The way the configuration of Waikiki is now is it's in an unstable state. We've tried to force beaches onto an area where there were very narrow beaches in the past, and that doesn't work well for a resort district. So we've built beaches where they don't naturally exist, and that creates all kinds of problems. But in recognizing that, one of our biggest challenges right now is finding beach-quality sand. In the past, sand was taken from other beaches around the state, including on Molokai. Papuhaku on Molokai was a major source, Waimanalo, the North Shore, even Nanakuli. And if you go far enough back, they just took it right from the beach. They mined it actively from the beach, and we, of course, don't do that now. So we're really looking at offshore sand sources, which makes it extremely difficult to get and expensive. And I was struck with the recording of the guy talking about the suction dredging. That's the same technology that we use now to restore beaches, is you suck sand from an offshore sand field and pump it to the beach. Typically, it's how it's done. So we're looking at having to maybe make plans for the next offshore beach restoration using offshore sand. And that's going to be probably a every 10 years type of project. We're also interested in pursuing plans to develop smaller scale as needed nourishment efforts, where we have a scaled down system, maybe even a hand suction dredge similar to the super sucker that the DLNR uses for invasive algae, something that a one person diver could operate and move sand around on a much smaller scale, lower impact type basis. So those are the kind of things that we're pursuing in Waikiki to try to maintain the beaches.
Andrew, doesn't the city have some kind of plan also to deal with an eroding, I don't know if it was some kind of landscaping area abutting your aquarium?
I don't know what they've got planned out there, but I was just going to ask Dolan, are there any plans for artificial reefs to help buffer the effect of wave action?
There aren't any plans yet, but there's been some discussion about tying the beach restoration efforts to conservation efforts for the reef as well.
Yeah, I would jump in with that and say it would be a great opportunity to also reintroduce corals to some area and see if they propagate there. And then if that succeeded, the fish would colonize naturally and you'd get back up to something approaching what it used to be.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. This came up in a meeting that we had recently with DLNR, that these are challenging projects to try to kick off. But if we're talking about a major engineering project, building new structures and things like that, typically what's required from the Army Corps of Engineers is some form of what they call compensatory mitigation. So if you put rocks on even an algal reef. So a lot of the nearshore reef in Waikiki is not a really pristine reef. It's more of coralline algae, but it is a live reef. And if you have no other option than put rocks on it, you need to compensate through some form. And we're thinking maybe a form of mitigation might be to do a reef restoration project nearby to mitigate the potential impact to the reef.
We do have a call on the line. Rick from Honolulu, do you have a question?
Hi, yes. I have been studying the environmental impact statement, and as you know, there are two plans on in play. One is a new beach plan. The other is the perimeter deck plan. Regarding the silt that Dr. Rossiter and talked about earlier, that silt, according to an environmental impact statement study by Sea Engineering this year, says that the silt will not only go in an ebb direction, it will also go into Kaimana Beach, depending on which way the littoral drift is going that particular day. And upon occasion, the beach will be closed, says this report. The environmental impact statement for the beach plan mitigates the silt by grading it, placing an environmental cover over it, covering that with gravel, and then covering that with 2 feet of sand. The new perimeter deck plan has no budget nor any plan whatsoever for mitigating this silt, which will be flow freely through its graded walls into the ocean. So I think that's really important, and I'd like to hear Dr. Rossiter and Dolan's ideas about that. Thank you.
Who wants to take that?
I guess I'll take a stab at that. Thank you for the call, Rick. And I think, yeah, the mitigation of the silt material that we've described as being several feet thick in the natatorium basin now is problematic. I think that's something that needs to be addressed. Allowing it to just freely flush out into the open ocean in the nearshore environment is not really I don't see how that's going to not have a big negative impact. So it's not the end of the world. There are ways to mitigate it, as Rick mentioned, for the beach design. And there's another analogy here with the Hilton Lagoon, the Tukanamoku Lagoon. When they restore that, they simply put they didn't remove it. They put a geotextile layer down, and then they put sand on top of that. So there are ways that you can mitigate it without it costing, you know, tens of millions of dollars. But I think there needs to be some more thought put into how we mitigate this fine silt, because it is going to be a problem. If you have too much fine silt, it can obviously smother the reef and cause all kinds of impacts to the nearshore.
So much for your reef restoration if there's going to be a major silt problem. Mm. And Andrew?
Yeah, agree with everything that Dolan has just said. The silt is and always will be a big problem unless it's removed. Even if it's underneath the natatorium, there will be seepage of nitrates, nitrites into the natatorium water itself, which will probably precipitate large algal blooms, and you'll have a natatorium that's essentially bright green and cloudy in color.
Interesting to kind of think about projects that are on the drawing board right now and what we need to do and how to mitigate all these issues relating to protecting Waikiki.
And the impacts really of not only the foreseen but the unforeseen. I mean, dealing with issues of weather and change and storms that may have impacts that we are not anticipating. And Andrew, I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, exactly. I think in projects like this, it's very important to get as many different perspectives as possible, because if you're just a pure engineer, you're looking at the physical structure. If you're a biologist, you're looking at something else. If you're a geologist, you're looking at the substructure. But to get all these different perspectives together, then you'll get an overarching view of what to do right, what could go wrong, and how to resolve the issues.
And is there a forum that you gentlemen are involved in that touches on that, or that is, again, looking to that glass half full, to the way forward? Is there something that...
Well, one thing I could add, with respect to the natatorium, I'm not aware of any particular working group or anything like that. At least I'm not part of it. There probably is something internal to the city where they've had a team of people looking at it beyond just the production of the EIS. But in Waikiki, as part of this Waikiki Beach District, actually ends at the Kapahulu Groin. But if you think of Kapahulu Groin to the Alawai, we have formed a working committee. It's the Waikiki Beach Community Advisory Committee, and it's largely composed of beach boys, lifeguards, operators on the beach, government officials, and we've been asking very specific questions about what should we be doing in Waikiki and what is your vision of Waikiki. Of course, that committee's responsibility doesn't extend as far down as the natatorium, but it might serve as a good model mm-hmm. that we could look at.
We've got less than a minute. Any final thoughts, gentlemen?
Where do we begin? Maybe just one final thought that I could share is we have a rich history in Waikiki. We heard from the Beach Boy or a Beach Boy earlier. I just wanted to mention that that's an important cultural connection to the ocean in Waikiki that we don't want to lose sight of. And there's a lot of changes happening in Waikiki, but we're trying to pay tribute and close attention to its cultural and recreational history as well.
Andrew?
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. Obviously, the habitat there has changed greatly. The ecology has changed greatly. It's unlikely we'll get it back to where it was, but there's a huge, huge opportunity here for getting it better than where it is now.
Okay. Well, Bill Dorman and I would like to thank our guests, Andrew Rossiter, Waikiki Aquarium Director, and Dolan Eversall, geologist with the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us here on today's show. And if your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact our talkback line and leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.